Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another Bitcoin Standard podcast seminar. In today's seminar, we're going to be discussing the topic of energy and how it relates to Bitcoin. I'm finishing up currently chapter 8 of Principles of Economics, my economics textbook, which is available to subscribers. If you sign up on SaifEddin.com, you can get a weekly chapter, 1 week from Principles of Economics and the next week from the Fiat Standard, my other book. If you sign up, you will be receiving these emails once a month, plus you will have access to all of my online courses. And if you sign up for Membership Plus, you can join these seminars, which take place twice a week. So far, I've written 16 chapters, well, 15, 8 from the Fiat Standard and 7 from Principles of Economics that have been sent out. And the 16th or the 8th from Principles will be sent out today or tomorrow in the next couple of days. And I thought, you know, having finished up this chapter and as I sit there and polish it up, I thought it would be very useful to reiterate the main points and discuss them with how they relate to Bitcoin, particularly as we are witnessing a resurgence of the many complaints about Bitcoin spending too much energy and consuming too much energy and Bitcoin wasting too much electricity and all of that stuff. So I think the analysis of the economics of energy is a great way to begin to address this question, because regular listeners and attendees of the seminar will probably know I've got a slightly different perspective on these questions than what you will generally hear in most media and academia, really. And we've had before on this podcast, we've had a couple of interviews
We've had one interview with Alex Epstein. We also had another seminar where I talk about energy. And I highly recommend Alex Epstein's work on the economics of energy. He's got a great book called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. And it's a really, really powerful argument. And it's a really important book because it's not something you hear or see very often, but it's looking very realistically at fossil fuels as an economic product and looking at what they provide us and all the goods that they go into and just how important and transformative they were for our standard of living. And I think reading Epstein's book, it was published many years ago, and I've read it maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago or so. But it was very influential for me in thinking about energy because I found it to be a very powerful way of understanding energy. And I think it points to the key, I think, insight you get from the importance of hydrocarbons, I think, is one that can best be understood for somebody who has learned economics from the Austrian tradition. So if you've taken the courses on saifedean.com, Economics 11 and Economics 12, the discussion of subjective valuation and the discussion of marginal analysis are extremely important toward understanding the realities of the energy market today. And I think this is essentially what I try and do in this chapter on energy. So if you're subscribed to Principles of Economics, you should be receiving the chapter. So you've seen the structure of the book. The book begins in the first chapter. We discuss human action approach to economics and how it differs from the traditional mainstream approach. And then in the second chapter, we discuss the economics of time. And in the third chapter, we discuss time. In the first two chapters, we do an introduction. We discuss marginal analysis and subjective value. Then in the third chapter, we discuss the economics of time. And the way that I structured this book is that I made it so that the discussion of time is central to the exposition of all of the topics of the book. In other words, once I explain time in chapter three, I, based on the work of Julian Simon, whom I've mentioned on this podcast several times before, based on the work of Julian Simon, and this is something I also mentioned in the Bitcoin Standard, we understand that human time is the ultimate scarcity. It's the ultimately scarce thing because it's the one thing that we can't just continue to make more of indefinitely. But with all other materials and resources, we continue to make more and more of them. But economics, even though, you know, we think of economics as being about material things in economics are merely tools and pawns in the larger economic, in the larger economizing picture, which really is about economizing time. Humans are economizing their time by trying to extend the amount of time that they have on Earth. So by surviving and maintaining their health and being able to live for long and doing all of the things that can help them achieve this. And humans are also trying to improve the quality of their time by having more resources to allow them to enjoy life and to be safe from threats and dangers. So really, if you think about it from this perspective, it really is, you can see how everything that we do is ultimately the currency of life. Everything we do is denominated in the currency of life, and the currency of life is time. You know, that's what life is about. You're born. You're there for a bunch of time and then you die. And, you know, you don't bring anything with you and you don't take anything with you. All you have really is time. And if you think about it this way, we can see all aspects of economizing. We can understand them. All economic action is ultimately about economizing time. And if we think about it in this, I chose this as the methodological or as the style of exposition for the book, because it helps us approach each one of those topics from their economic importance and from their economic incentive and from their economic significance. So, you know, we begin with thinking of labor. This is essentially the simplest and most basic way in which individuals can work to improve their lives, to economize time. So, you know, ultimately your time needs to be divided between labor and between leisure, or things that you enjoy doing for their own sake versus labor, which is things that you do for the sake of the outcome that you get out of them. And so having to economize between labor and leisure is the question that all humans have always had. So we begin with that, with labor, and then we move on to discussing property, which is another tool that humans have developed in order to improve the quantity and the quality of time that they have to economize on time. And then we discuss capital, which is a specific part type of property, which is not property that is consumed, but property that produces consumption goods. And this is, of course, an enormously important topic in economics, which I believe does not get enough attention in most mainstream treatments of economics. There's not much discussion of capital. Having finished with capital, the next chapter moves on to discuss technology, which is a form of capital that is not physical. We can think of technology as all of the ideas that go into economic production processes. And this is not something that is material. It's not something that you can touch. And yet it's something that's extremely valuable to individuals because it has enormous utility. And really, ideas are arguably the most important form of capital we have, because physical capital will constantly decay. But ideas are extremely powerful. They don't decay and they can't be destroyed. And well, I mean, they could potentially be destroyed, but it's much harder to destroy them. And the more that technology advances, the easier it becomes to replicate and maintain knowledge. Having looked at these, I decided to add a chapter. You know, if you took the course, you wouldn't see this as a lecture in the course. But after I completed the course, I decided to add this chapter to the book, specifically discussing the economics of energy. And in other words, I thought to myself, the coming chapter after this will move toward discussing trade and then discussing economic discussing money and then the market order in general. And then we move toward discussing money and banking in detail. But as I was saying, the framework that puts everything together is we look at each one of these topics in terms of how it helps humans economize and how it helps humans carry out economic decision-making. So before moving on to trade, I decided that there must be a chapter specifically on energy, because I think it's the economics of it are extremely important. And I believe the Austrian analysis of energy is extremely productive. If you apply the Austrian methodology toward understanding how energy markets work, I think there's a very important insight, which can explain a lot of what is happening in the world in terms of energy grid failures around the world that we see, as well as rising costs of electricity in many places around the world. So if we begin with it from thinking about it in terms of the economizing of human time, and this is really, again, thanks to Alex Epstein's book. In his book, he presents energy. He thinks of energy as calories that are needed to do work. And one very, very powerful mechanism of understanding the economics of energy is to realize that currently, the average person living in the U.S. or in your average rich country, they consume something around the energy consumption of around 200 human beings. It's as if they have 200 slaves that wake up every morning and spend all day working for them. This is how much energy the average American, I think, I forget the exact number, but it's somewhere around 200. This is the exact amount of energy, or the average amount of energy that the average American has at their disposal every day. So effectively, you've got 200 slaves essentially running around and meeting all your needs. So when you think about lighting candles, I mean, lighting your light, that consumes energy. Without electricity and without modern forms of energy, you would require people to produce candles and to bring the candles for you and to light the candles and to maintain the candles. And, you know, not only is it equivalent in terms of energy to around 200 people's energy, but in terms of the quality of what it does, it's extremely better than what individual slaves would be able to do. In other words, a car is not just a different way of doing things than having slaves push you around. It's a much faster and much more productive way of doing it. And so it constantly allows us to economize our time by, instead of having to spend the energy of individuals on moving us around, we're able to utilize very high amounts of energy that are directed toward doing the work that we want. And so transportation is one of those works, is one of those important types of work. We move from A to B. We've always moved. People have always had reasons to move their stuff around and move themselves. And this is something that you can imagine will always continue. You know, crops need to be moved and all sorts of things need to be transported. So the way that I like to begin the chapter is with trying to think about transportation as it would happen with a small amount of energy versus transportation with a high or large amount of energy. So if you wanted to move, say, 500 pounds of produce from your farm to the town where you want to sell it, if you wanted to do this by yourself, let's say it was a two-hour walk, you'd have to probably do this over 10 walks. So five times a day, you have to go back and forth. So that's two work days for you to just be able to move this 500 pound of butter, let's say, and send them to the town to be sold. On the other hand, if you had a horse, you could maybe do it in two trips or maybe even one trip. You just load up the horse and you go. Well, 500 pounds, probably too much for a horse. But you could do it with two trips and it'll be much faster. But if you have a car, you can do the whole trip in 20 minutes. You know, you go and you come back in 20 minutes and it's a much faster way of doing it. So thinking of it this way, thinking of energy as being machine calories, as being food for calories, and thinking of machines as being slaves that are serving our needs is a useful way of understanding the economic reality of why people use energy, why people like all of these things that spend all this incredibly large amount of energy all over the world. Why do they spend so much money on them all over the world? Why do they need all these engines? And the answer is it's extremely effective for our time. It's an extremely effective way of economizing our time. So when you've got 200 people, the equivalent of 200 slaves working for you, that means you don't have to do much. You don't have to carry heavy things. You don't have to go and lug wood in order for you to make a fire so that you can have hot water that you can shower with. You turn a faucet and hot water comes in. You flick a light and the electricity comes in. All of these machine slaves effectively are using all that energy to provide you all of that thing at a flick of a button. It's extremely effective. Move toward heavily energy intensive economic production was essential toward the liberation of slaves and the dismantling of slavery. I think if you think about it economically, the amount of energy that you are consuming every day, you know, think about a primitive society. If you were a nomadic society or if you were a group of herders, the amount of energy that you consume every day is essentially the energy of your body. You know, you have your own body there and you're able to use it for taking care of your own life. And you might make a little bit of surplus energy from a wood forest where you chop down wood maybe to light fire. But for nomads, you know, energy sources weren't very extensive. So the amount of energy that you would be using is roughly equal to around the amount of energy that you produce yourself. That's all the energy that is available for you. On the other hand, once we move toward agriculture, once humans began to settle down, we started inventing all those new technologies that allow us to have more energy access. So we start utilizing windmills, start utilizing rivers and streams. We start utilizing the energy of animals, of course. That's when we domesticate animals. And now we have animals that produce energy for us. And so in agricultural society, being able to own an animal was an enormous marker of wealth, because having an animal meant that you had roughly triple or maybe quadruple the amount of work that you could do in that animal. So instead of just having to feed yourself with your own hands every day and having to provide for yourself with your own hands, all of the energy that is keeping you alive is your own energy. When you have an animal farm, a farm animal, you've got three or four or five, depending on the animal, three or four or five times your own body energy out there. And of course, being an animal, you know, it's not out there, being a farm animal, it's not out there to enjoy itself. It's out there working for you. So this is why, you know, you can understand why cattle were extremely valuable, because they could do work as well. But then in the Industrial Revolution, that's when really things changed drastically. In these worlds in which your ability to have energy in your own life was roughly 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times what you could bring yourself. In that kind of world in which your own energy is a significant chunk of the amount of energy that you can bring into your life, let's say you've got you and a horse, that's a world in which having another human being dedicated to serving you is extremely valuable. Because if I could convince somebody, or if I could threaten them or find a way to have them dedicate their time and their life and their energy toward meeting my needs for most people, this would have been a doubling of their wealth, effectively, because you go from doubling of the energy available for them today. So if you get yourself a slave, you're able to effectively double your life quality, more or less, because the majority of the slave's work is now going to go to you. And, you know, depending on how much the slave is more productive than you or less productive than you, you're roughly doubling your own productivity. So instead of you having 2,000 calories of your own to spend on keeping yourself alive, now that you've gotten a slave, you'll have 3,000 or 3,500 calories being spent every day on keeping you alive. So you can imagine slavery in that kind of situation is enormously valuable, right? It would be extremely valuable to be able to have a slave. And so people in many places all over the world, people engaged in slavery because it was extremely valuable to have this much additional energy available for you. Now, what happens with industrialization and the move toward utilizing hydrocarbons? And really, that starts in the second millennium in, you know, the 15, 16, 1700s. We start using more and more coal, but really the real transformative impact of energy, the inflection point where energy transformed human life significantly and noticeably, was in the beginning of the 19th century, because that was the invention of the steam engine. And then with the 19th century and with global trade opening up around the world, when with more and more of the world on the gold standard and trading with one another, in that world, and, you know, with lower and lower time preference and more capital accumulation, more inventions coming up, that's when a lot of inventions came about. And of course, these inventions themselves were, to a large extent, the product of the introduction of hydrocarbons into industry. So once we started using coal effectively, then we could start finding more applications of things to do with coal. And over time, coal and then oil with the internal combustion engine, which happened at the early 20th century. Over time, coal and oil continued to find more and more uses. This was when the age of inventions took off, because you had this dead and mute source of energy that can do work for human beings. And you had an almost infinite array of tasks that human beings do for themselves every day. And with this force of energy, the inventors then were unleashed to imagine, how can you bring this energy to bear on all of these tasks that human beings are performing? And so with electricity and with energy, you know, we started first with engines and pumps, and all of these things began to get more and more mechanized. Trains became possible, then cars became possible, then domestic appliances. You know, each one of them uses large amounts of energy to save human beings from drudgery of work. You know, the washing machine was a huge one, because instead of having to have a human being spend hours every day washing clothes and sorting out how to wash them with their own hand, consuming their own energy into it, you could now get it in an appliance which just consumes dead matter and gives you clean clothes. So as more and more of these technologies continue to be revealed and unleashed and discovered and popularized and commercialized, productivity continued to increase. And as a result, we got to a point now where each person has something like 200 slaves working for them every day in terms of the amount of energy that they're able to dedicate toward meeting their own ends. So what does this then do to the value of having a slave when this is the case? When you've got already 200 slaves in the form of coal and oil and maybe even nuclear and hydroelectric that are basically being churned into your household or beamed into your household to meet your needs and to produce the things that you care about. Think about how significant it becomes to have a slave in this kind of world. What would you say? What do you think? Is it more valuable or less valuable?
Less valuable.
Yeah, less valuable. Why?
Because you can get your needs met without slavery.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, but I mean, you kind of always have, but I think the difference ultimately is about the cost, you know. So getting an extra slave in the form of electricity or in the form of coal or oil is just far cheaper than trying to subjugate an entire human being. And so the rationale for, you know, for going from 200 to 201 at the margin, and this really, again, you know, the marginal analysis is really helpful when thinking about this, going from the 200th slave to the 201 slave costs you very little money if that slave energy comes from hydrocarbon energy. But if you wanted to get it from a human being, it's going to be massively, massively more expensive. The other aspect of it is that as industrialization takes off and as productivity increases with technological growth, what happens now is the worker is now much more valuable because they are handling very intricate and expensive equipment. And so if you have a slave handling heavy equipment, handling expensive equipment, you know, this is asking for trouble, because if they're unhappy, if they're not motivated to be working out of their own intrinsic motivation because they want to be working, as opposed to getting whipped and getting forced into working because they were born into slavery because of this, they're unlikely to be useful and productive with heavy equipment. You can imagine they would actually sabotage it. And so if you really want to think about the abolition of slavery, we have to understand the role that energy played, the economics of energy played in it, because by making energy so cheap and affordable and available at low prices, it increased the productivity of human beings massively, and it eliminated or reduced drastically the value from grunt labor, you know, from menial labor, from force, from people pushing things and moving things. There's very, very little value now in having a human being push a cart of building material or whatever from one part of town to the other, because a car can do it much faster. And so all of these kind of menial slave jobs for which slaves were particularly suited, because you could easily, you know, you could, as long as we're in a primitive state, you could have somebody whipping the slaves and overseeing the work that they're doing. But as you move towards something intricate and expensive and complicated like a factory, you can't afford that. You can't be whipping people who are dealing with expensive equipment. It's not a useful strategy. They'll sabotage it at any attempt that they do, they can. And also, the kind of tasks that became required from labor became much more cerebral, much more intelligent. So effectively, what the explosion of cheap energy has given us is that it made our human labor, our power, our ability to push and lift things, become almost worthless, because a very cheap machine can replace anything that you can do with your strength. What actually became valuable with high energy is the human mind, the ability of the individual to command that high energy. So it doesn't matter how strong you are now in terms of moving stuff from point A to point B. And it doesn't even matter how many slaves you have who will help you move things from point A to point B. Nothing will be faster as a way of moving things from point A to point B than having a machine that does it, having a car. You know, there's no amount of hard work that can make slaves beat a specially designed truck for the movement of things. And so what this means is that the value of a human being, the value of the time of a human being, has become enormously more valuable because we no longer have to do the grunt work. We no longer need to move heavy things around by whipping people to move them around. We just need one guy that we can trust to operate a car properly and drive them from point A to point B. And the productivity of the job is so high that you would pay somebody to do it, even if they're not a slave. That's the key thing. On the one side, there's, you know, the demand story and the supply story. And on the from the supply side, the more energy you have, the more productive economic production, and therefore the more you'd be willing to pay for having somebody produce this. And that's why, you know, think about the transportation industry. No matter how much energy we continue to put into it, and no matter how much technological innovation goes into it, we don't eliminate the jobs of people working in transportation. But the jobs of people working in transportation increase in their productivity enormously. We go from slaves who had to be whipped in order to do the job. And now, you know, people who work in transportation include some extremely highly sought after engineers, and they get paid much more. And you don't even have to look at the engineers. You know, even the lowest paid menial workers today who are able to work in transportation, if they're able to work with capital, you know, if you work as just helping move things around in a large transportation company or in an airline, you'll be earning so much more than what somebody in your same job would have done 3,000 years ago. Because you'd be able to move things around much, much, much more productively. You have all kinds of machines to be moving things around. So as our deployment of energy increases, our productivity increases, and the amount of money we can pay to people to do the jobs for us increases. And so that's really, you know, when people talk about energy consumption, I think this is a point that gets overlooked, that it's really the increase in energy consumption and energy production, obviously, that has freed us. Freed the majority of slaves in the world. It's the fundamental driver of this. And it's no coincidence that abolition of slavery happened more or less along with the spread of industrial production. And if you think about it historically, you see that as industrialization was spreading, slavery was moving away. And a good example of this would be in the US, where in the North, because the North was industrial, there were very few slaves compared to the South, where the South was rural and agrarian. The most important jobs in the North were in factories, and slaves were just never good for working in factories because, you know, you couldn't trust them with the machinery. So in the North, the workers were better paid than in the South. And in the South, many of the workers were slaves because in the South, you didn't have modern technology, hadn't entered as much as it had in the North. And so you see this trend happening all over the world, that as industrialization comes in, the value of slave labor declines, and with it, the value of productive free labor increases. And that leads to increases in productivity and the removal or the ending of slave labor. It's a very useful way of thinking about it because that's ultimately what energy is doing. I think the important thing is to understand that this is what energy is all about. You know, if you're thinking to yourself, we consume too much energy, you're effectively saying we need to have fewer energy slaves working for us. We need to have fewer fuels making things for us. And that's just necessarily going to mean that human beings are going to be needing to do more of that grunt work that we have been automating away for the past couple of hundred years. And so that necessarily means more and more humans will do low productivity labor that they don't desire. So my favorite example, which I've been banging on Twitter for a while, is washing machines. Washing machines, I think they're a great example because they viscerally drive home the point. You know, nobody wants to be washing their clothes with their own hand. It's extremely tedious and it's time consuming and it's no fun. Nobody enjoys it. People don't even enjoy doing their laundry in the machine that handles 90%, 99% of the grunt work. So having more energy means when you want to wash your clothes, you are able to just press a few buttons, commandeer the machine, and the machine does the work. Having less energy means having no washing machine and having to wash with your hands. That's really what the cost of it is. And I think the dangerous thing is that if you look at what's been happening to energy markets around the world, because of the introduction of what is called renewable energy, but is actually better understood as unreliable energy sources, the energy sources that are not available and reliable 24/7 on demand, these are leading to large increases in the price of energy across the industrial world, which is the reversal of many thousand year trend of economic progress through the command of more and more energy into our daily lives. We're constantly finding ways of making energy cheaper and more available, and we continue to find more and more plentiful energy. And that kind of begins to break down around in the last 50 years as we start, and this is going to be a topic I discuss in the Fiat Standard in a chapter that's going to be coming in the next few weeks on fiat energy. Since the 1970s, there have been all kinds of political agendas aiming for driving the use of energy away from hydrocarbons and toward renewable or unreliable energy sources. But what we really value is not energy. And what we really value is power. And that's something that Austrian economics can help us understand very usefully. If you remember, in the first chapter in Principles of Economics, and in the first lecture in Economics 11, the course on saifeddin.com, we begin by explaining marginal analysis and explaining subjective valuation. And we explain there's the water diamond paradox, which is why is it that if water is clearly much more essential and much more important to people than diamonds, and yet diamonds are much more expensive? How can economics explain this? And the answer is that we can explain it in terms of the decisions being made at the margin. Nobody has to choose between diamonds and water. If you made it in a way so that you say you turn 18 and then you have to pay $1,000, let's say, for a lifetime supply of waters or a lifetime supply of diamonds, if you had to make an exclusive choice between the two, the majority of people would obviously choose water. But you don't have to make that choice. And so you end up living in places and locations that have a lot of plentiful water so that you are able to get a lot of water every day. And so that the marginal cost of the next unit of water is always very little. You know, you don't want to live in a place where every time you need a sip of water, it's extremely expensive for you to secure it. On the other hand, diamonds are very hard to, well, you know, they're not as hard as Bitcoin, but they're marketed to appeal to the hardness and to the idea that they're hard to make. And, you know, to be fair, they are harder than water, which is a pretty easy bar to clear. So because of that, you know, very few people have a lot of diamonds. And so the marginal value of the first diamond that you get for somebody is extremely large because, well, not for everyone, but it would likely be pretty high because very few people have any diamonds. And those who do don't have all that many. So ultimately, it's not about the value of the good in general. That's not what determines our valuation. What determines our valuation of a good is the valuation we make at the time and the place where we need it. And when you think about it this way, that's really the, in my mind, I think it's a very useful way of trying to understand the distinction between energy and power. And that's an enormously, enormously important distinction because energy is extremely abundant. We have an enormous amount of energy all over the world, and the amount of energy that falls on Earth every day from the sun is many multiples of the amount of energy that we consume, not just in the day, but I think it's multiples of the entire amount of energy that humans consume in a year. So we don't have an energy shortage. You know, the Earth is spinning, which means that we're constantly getting wind, which means we have almost infinite quantities of wind energy all over the world. The sun is shining somewhere on the planet at any point in time. And so we're constantly absorbing energy from the sun in enormous quantities. There are incredibly large amounts of hydrocarbons in the Earth's crust that continue to grow. You know, no matter how much people continue to freak out about we're going to run out of oil and gas, we continue to find more, and our reserves continue to grow. And it's you know, the quantity of these things that exist on Earth, under the Earth, is much larger than we can even try and estimate. And I discussed that as well in Chapter 3 on the scarcity. So these sources of energy are pretty abundant and available. And of course, they're valuable in their right time and their right places. But in order to have all of the nice things that make our modern world possible, in order to have all of these things and have them functioning and have them relieve us of drudgery and relieve us of hard slave work, we need to have high power. And power refers specifically to quantity of energy over unit of time, and you know, how much energy you can bring in over a unit of time. So solar energy, there's an enormous amount of solar energy that hits the planet, but it's not very useful, or it's not very easy to turn it into high amounts of power. So, you know, you can sit in the sun, you can absorb a lot of the energy of the sun. You can grow plants by letting them absorb the energy of the sun. But if you wanted to operate a high power vehicle, you know, if you wanted to operate a V8 engine, or if you wanted to operate a washing machine, which is going to run for 90 minutes or whatever of spinning and heating and rinsing, you need a mechanism for taking all of that energy and focusing it into very high bursts of energy in small increments of time, so that we get a very high number of joules per second. And that's what a watt is, which is the measure of power. So when you think about it this way, from the Austrian perspective, you know, it's not, it doesn't matter overall valuation of whether you think the sun is more important than fossil fuels. Just like it's not about the overall valuation of whether you think diamonds are more important than water. What matters is at the margin, in the situation in which you're going to be needing the energy source, which one can provide you the high power? You know, at that margin, which one can you connect to your washing machine and you can have it reliably give the washing machine all the watts that it needs in order to operate and wash your clothes? And the answer for that is hydrocarbons. It's pretty clear that this is the case, because nobody likes to admit this, but we can't really have our modern life without hydrocarbons. We need those fuels because they are the ones that are able to provide us with high amounts of power on demand at any time and at any point. And, you know, people talk about, well, we're going to fix wind and solar energy and make them efficient once we have a good battery technology. But they miss the fact that the best battery technology, nature's battery, is hydrocarbons. You know, you take these relatively stable gases that are extremely dense with energy. In a couple of centuries, we've built enormous distribution lines for processing them and producing them. And it allows you to, you know, you get a one gas canister and it can keep you warm, keep your house warm. It can, you can cook on it. And it's a much, it's, you know, compare a gas canister linked to an oven and stovetop. Compare how much work that requires and how much energy you can get, and try and compare that to how much energy you would need if you wanted to log wood in order to produce the same amount of cooking. Think about just how much more efficient the gas canister is as a battery. Or think about the gasoline that goes into your car. Or think about the gasoline and the diesel that goes into portable engines, which, and electricity generators, which you can take anywhere in the world. You know, you take a gas tank and you take the engine and you can have electricity anywhere in the world. This ability to be available on demand, high power on demand, is something that is what makes fossil fuels so valuable. What do you guys think? What do you want to say?
Saifedean, how would you address cost of war and ownership over fossil fuels and the impoverishing of the local people, as we've seen, you know, over the last many decades, say in Venezuela or in the Mid East, because that's an additional cost on the economy to have these access to these fuels, or how they're controlled and distributed?
Yeah, I mean, the discussion so far is from the engineering perspective. This is not the political perspective. So I'm just explaining the enormous importance of these resources. But I think the obviously the politics of these resources in the 20th century are massively complicated and have caused all kinds of issues. But in my mind, I think that's ultimately a function of of government intervention, of government monopolies on these goods and on the production of these things. That's why we really end up with such a heavy human toll on it, because governments can control the production of it and have governments have monopolized and helped build monopolies for energy industry. So the other interesting thing about it, now that you mention it, is when we think of Bitcoin and we think of the energy consumption of Bitcoin, people tend to think that, well, look, if you read on, even if you understand Bitcoin's value proposition properly, as I like to see it, as an alternative to central banks, you'll quickly conclude that all the world's central banks spend nowhere near as much electricity as Bitcoin does, and Bitcoin is only going to get more, is only going to be spending more and more over time. Its energy consumption is likely to go up. So there's no question in my mind that Bitcoin is more consuming of energy than central banks when you just look at central banks in isolation. But when you think about the actual way in which the monetary system works, you know, it needs more than just building a central bank and having a printer and having a central bank governor who goes on TV and says, we're going to print more money every week. It takes more than that in order to be able to have the currency and have people accept it. You know, the essentially what the fiat century meant was it was about fighting war. You know, the ability to secure a printer was ultimately required national sovereignty and required winning wars. And the country that ended up with the most important printer is the one that could win the most wars, is the one that won the wars and imposed its terms. So if you really want to think about it, the energy consumption of the monetary system, that is the fiat monetary system, determination of the proof of work of who gets to issue coins and who gets to reward coins in the fiat system does not just happen from the central banks. It happens apolitically. It happens politically through wars. And so if you really want to compare energy expenditure, you want to include the energy expenditure that goes on war, because A, fiat money allows the financing of war excessively, and B, fiat money, the ability to produce it is essentially dependent on being able to fight wars. And so a money that doesn't need government for it to operate is money that doesn't need to fight wars. And so the real cost, when you think about the fiat system and you want to compare it to Bitcoin, in my mind, is reflected in the proof of work. And I think once you understand what I was discussing on in terms of the economics of energy and power, you can see that still, you know, winning wars is a function of energy. The government that can marshal more power into, and I mean that in the sense of joules and kilowatts, the government that can marshal the most kilowatts in the service of its war will necessarily win. Think about the U.S. government launching nuclear war, and think about all the bombings that the U.S. government is able to carry out. I mean, this is effectively how the proof of work works in the fiat system. You won't be able to just get the right to print the world's currency by telling people, hey, I could win a war if I wanted to. You're going to have to actually fight wars. And you need to spend a lot of energy in order to be able to fight wars. You know, the wars are not fought with sticks and stones. Wars are fought with heavily complicated machinery. And whoever is able to command the fastest and best and highest energy fighter jets and aircraft carriers and nuclear weapons and all different forms of weaponry, whoever is able to command more energy in their artillery and in their military in general is effectively doing the proof of work, is going to win the war. And that's really how you can see the proof of work in the fiat system. You can think of it as having to fight wars in order to keep the fiat network running. And that's, you know, to go back to your question, Kiki, this is how you can think of the real cost of oil and all of the politics that goes into this system, is because there's no easy way of reaching consensus without all of this bloody fighting. And this is the problem with, you know, when people start moaning about Bitcoin mining and they start saying, well, we're going to have this new crypto that is built on proof of stake and it's going to be much better because it's proof of stake and it's not going to spend energy. Well, you know, the way that proof of stake works is essentially through military enforcement. You know, the reason that you can't opt out of a proof of stake currency like the fiat dollar and opt into a proof of work currency like gold is because of, actually, I should rephrase that. I wouldn't say that fiat is a proof of stake currency. I would say both are proof of work currencies. And the reason that you can impose the fiat system and the fiat money is because of the proof of work that goes into the military and the police closing down competitors and bombing foreigners that choose to do something else. So, you know, without proof of work, nobody has any interest. Nobody has any reason to put their money in an altcoin or in a coin or in anything. You know, if, nobody would hold a form of money that was just purely government backed paper. You know, if governments came out and said, all right, we're going to print a new form of money and it's this paper and it's redeemable for nothing and everybody has to use it, you know, people aren't going to pay their good money for that willingly. They'd rather have the good money that can be used outside the country. So the way they get them to accept these currencies is essentially through the proof of work of violence and through the proof of work of war. And that's what Bitcoin fixes. In other words, Bitcoin's proof of work mining is a peaceful way of arriving at consensus without having to launch world wars. So it may take up more electricity than even the nuclear wars and the world wars. It'll be an interesting question someday. You know, I'm sure somebody might run the numbers and tell us one day that, you know, Bitcoin's consuming more energy than World War II, but I doubt it. And the important thing, of course, is not whether it consumes more energy than World War II. The important thing is that it doesn't consume as many human beings as World War II. So, you know, if Bitcoin ends up being a more energy intensive use, more an energy intensive way of producing proof of work, that Bitcoin consumes more energy than all of World War II, than all of the world's military conflicts, you know, effectively to say that this is a waste of energy is to say that, well, no, let's have hundreds of millions of people die in wars like we did in the last century because to save on the electricity bill, essentially. So, you know, Bitcoin is a digital electronic way of achieving proof of work consensus on the validity of the network and the supply without having to kill human beings and without having to turn it into politics and without having to rely on the you know, honesty and well-meaning intentions of other human beings. It's just a way to make this process into a into an automated process. In the same way, really, in the same way that you can think about washing machines, you know, they've moved the issue of washing from being from having to be done with your hands into having to be done, into requiring far less time. And this is what progress is. We're constantly making energy cheaper, and that's leading to better conditions for human beings, better work conditions, higher productivity, better quality of life, and less conflict. I think this is an amazing implication of technology in that we no longer need to fight one another in order to figure out what to use as money. Markita, you have a question?
What I'm hearing is Bitcoin is helping to make our economy, the global economy, maybe more efficient in a similar way that, you know, the Industrial Revolution maybe helped to make the economy more efficient at that time.
I think so. I think this is really how we can think about it. The transformative power of technology unleashed by high energy sources, high power energy sources like fossil fuels, has essentially given us superior ways of doing everything. So we used to rely on carrier pigeons. Now we've got text messages far faster, and we can send a lot more and at a much lower cost. So the introduction of these things, you know, the examples are endless. Everything you can think of in your home is currently available there at the price that you're able to afford it because it was done with very high amounts of energy. You know, all the industrial goods that you use are produced with high amounts of energy. So all across our life, the ability of these machines to do work for us has infiltrated everywhere where menial work was done, and machines come along and do it better. And I think that a couple of hundred years of dealing with the consequences and building applications on top of the hydrocarbon stack, we finally managed to find a way to use electricity in order to run central banks. I mean, this is the way to think about it. Instead of just like the washing machine was a way of harnessing electricity in order to save people's time from having to wash with their own hands. Bitcoin does the same thing, but with central banks. It's going to save us from having to hire human beings to manage the monetary policy for us, because it allows us to run the monetary policy on an automated way, and also run international payments in a way that does not require a central bank and does not require a government to run the central bank, and is completely apolitical. So this is how you can understand the very high consumption of energy that Bitcoin does. First obvious answer is Bitcoin is consuming a lot of energy because somebody believes it's worth it. You know, people are storing their wealth in Bitcoin. And so, you know, there's clearly value that they find in it. These miners can't just be wasting energy. They're not wasting it because somebody's paying for it. So electricity is not something that is scarce, that is, you know, a limited amount. We've got a fixed earthly subscription and we have to decide how to allocate it. Electricity is something that anybody can produce. And so you just need an engine and many different kinds of engines can work for this, and you can make more electricity. So what Bitcoin is showing us is that people value it enough to keep paying the miners' bills and for the miners to keep coming back and buying it more. So clearly there must be value there. And I think with a lot of people, there's a mental block around this idea because they can't see the value themselves, because, you know, Bitcoin's not easy to grasp, not easy to understand. For most people, they heard about it as being a better Visa or better PayPal, and they heard about it as if it's going to replace these things. If you think about it this way, you know, that there's no reason to run a PayPal that consumes so much energy, and yet people continue to use it. So what are they seeing it? Well, maybe it's not a PayPal. Maybe it is an alternative to central banks. And now ask anybody who's been through a hyperinflation, which is probably a majority of people alive today. And of course, the vast majority have seen high inflation, not necessarily hyperinflation, but the vast majority have seen high inflation, constant erosion of their wealth. Is it worth it for you to be able to store some of your wealth, or maybe all of it, in a form of saving that doesn't require politics and can't be confiscated by your central bank? There are no wrong answers to this question. There are many people, the vast majority of the earth, think the answer is no. They still haven't seen enough in Bitcoin, and they haven't seen enough of their central bank to make the switch. So that's true for the majority of the people of the world. At least 99, probably more like 99% of the world's population has yet to upgrade from central bank to Bitcoin. But it's not true for the minority that have. It's not true because, you know, those people are choosing to dedicate their economic resources towards continuing to mine this. So there's clearly value in it there. When you think about it this way, it becomes a similar question to why should people get to use washing machines? You know, why should people get to use computers? Ultimately, there's basically nobody on the internet who can live without hydrocarbons. The mere fact that you're on the internet means that you're using a device that was made with hydrocarbons, transported with hydrocarbons. You're using supply chains that are entirely reliant on hydrocarbons. And the material that goes into all of the microchips, you know, it's an enormous quantity of hydrocarbons that goes into microchips. So if you want to live modern life where, you know, surviving winter is something that you can count on, that you don't think of as an ordeal, where your day is not wasted on drudgery, you're going to need this amount of high energy. And you're going to need high quantities of power to direct a lot of your life. And the reason that people can afford to virtue signal about, you know, we need to reduce the amount of electricity that we produce or consume, is because they take the products of hydrocarbons or electricity, the analysis is applicable to both. They take the products of these things for granted. This is one aspect of it. And then there's the other aspect, which is that a lot of these people just don't understand how engineering really works. Like in a sense of a lot of people think that the reason that all of the world's electronics companies use hydrocarbons in the manufacture of their goods is a simple design decision, you know, no different from, say, the color of the iPhone. So Apple makes currently, what is it, 4 different iPhones with 4 different colors. And so people think that the issue of, you know, what energy source they use is something cosmetic and it's a detail. And, you know, if only we could get the right people in charge of Apple, they would introduce the correct green color for the iPhones that I like. You know, I want the iPhone to be green. And if only we could have the right people in Apple, they'd make the phone green. You might get away with that. You might be able to do it. You know, you could launch a petition and you could do that, and you could get a job at Apple. You could buy Apple stocks and influence it. And you might be able to get green iPhones to be the default. But the choice of the energy that goes into it is not something that can be, it's not a cosmetic choice. You know, the way that we are able to build all of those things is, you know, engineers don't just sit there and choose between an endless array of techniques based on which one they think is, you know, sounds cooler now. There's no conspiracy out there to force them or encourage them to move to one particular kind of energy source or the other, but it's just the brutal economics of it. The real economics of it is that you will not be able to survive for a year. I wouldn't say you will not. I'd give the average person a 10% chance of survival for a whole year without hydrocarbons. You can choose to go anywhere in the world that doesn't have hydrocarbons and try and survive for a whole year on your own without utilizing any hydrocarbons, without utilizing any goods made from hydrocarbons. It can be done, obviously. A lot of people have done it. But I think for the people who live in modern society, I think the difficulty is going to be absolutely enormous. And the survival for a year is going to be an ordeal. You know, it's going to be wake up every morning and slave away in order to hopefully not die by the end of the day. Take it one day at a time and see if you can make it to the end line in a year. It's an interesting question how many people will be able to do it. I'd say, you know, 10% is a generous estimate of how many would succeed in it. But I think for 90%, you know, survival is probably out of the question. You know, you won't be able to get enough wood to survive the winter. And if you did, flooding might take away your home, or there's so many possibilities and so many ways for you to mess up with this. And I think really the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that it's going to teach the world this lesson. In particular, you know, the people who continue to complain about, Bitcoin is consuming too much energy, Bitcoin is wasting too much energy, they're forcing the world to come to terms with the question of, is that really a bad thing? Is it really a bad thing that we consume all this energy? If we're going to let a bunch of people who don't like Bitcoin to bully us out of using Bitcoin because it spends too much energy, you know, why stop at Bitcoin? Why not do the same thing with washing machines? You know, I think subjective valuations, you can't argue with them. Everybody has their own subjective valuation. But I think a lot of people will choose the rather, you know, if given the choice between a washing machine or having your entire livelihood stored in a currency that is run by a central bank, I personally choose to spend the day washing with my own hands. So none of these people who are complaining about Bitcoin's energy use, all of them are obviously complaining online, none of them see a problem with them using Twitter to complain about it, which, it consumes energy to get your device to run Twitter, and it consumes a lot of energy to run the Twitter servers. And, you know, you're just essentially using more electricity to talk about Bitcoin. And you think that that is important enough, that it is understandable for you to screech and shout at Bitcoiners for spending too much electricity. But Bitcoin itself is not important. You know, Bitcoiners don't deserve to run their own electricity for their own sake. But, you know, you deserve to get a washing machine and you deserve to get internet connection so that you can complain about Bitcoiners. The question is obviously unanswerable about where and how much energy can we consume. You can't answer it in the collective form. There's no collective mechanism for us to be able to determine, all right, as a human race, we're going to do washing machines, but we're not going to do dishwashers, and we're not going to do clothes dryers, and we're not going to do Bitcoin, but we're going to keep video games. There's no correct answer. The trade-offs are individual, and the value of those things are individual, and they're subjective. And people will decide where they want to dedicate their value. And if that ends up meaning that others will have to, if that ends up requiring energy, then essentially it's creating a market opportunity for others to produce energy in order to use it for production. And that's why, in reality, increase the production of energy and the consumption of energy are going to increase massively over the coming decades. There's no alternative. This is, you know, if you look at the vast majority of the world, the people who are poor all live in countries where consumption of energy is very low. If you live in a rich country, consumption of energy is very high. And that's something that most people who live in rich countries don't really appreciate. You know, you may not see all of the enormous amount of industrial infrastructure that's needed in order to make your home so safe and so warm, and you know, to make light available for you at a switch, and to make a washing machine turn on at a switch. All of that stuff takes an enormous amount of infrastructure and energy expenditure, and that's why it makes people so much more productive.
Yeah, I had a quick question about the situation that's been going on in Texas with the power outages over there, since we've been talking about energy. So it seems that there's been pretty severe outages over the winter. Texas has, during the last couple of decades, made this big transition towards wind power and made quite a big deal about that. And it seems that within the last few weeks, there have been about 4.5 million people who have been left without power for a sustained amount of time, and about $200 billion worth of economic damage resulting from that. So I wanted to just ask your take on what's happened in Texas. Some people are saying that this is due in part to like the natural gas pipelines freezing up. And some people are saying it's due to the kind of problems with the wind turbines and those freezing over and becoming unreliable. So I just wanted to ask what your take was on those sorts of phenomena and what they tell us about, you know, the reliability of fossil fuels over renewables.
Yeah, I think this is a great example. And we also see it in California, where they're getting more frequent power outages and calls for reducing power consumption during the summer when air conditioner use is high. The thing is, you know, 24-hour reliable electricity is not an incredible thing, an impossible thing to achieve. It's something that most human societies have managed to achieve. Well, not most societies, but all advanced and industrialized countries have managed to achieve by the probably 1960s or 70s. It's not that difficult to do it. You just need a very high power plant, a very high power capacity power plant that can produce the energy that you need at the time that you need it. Now, in terms of the weather, you know, Texas isn't the coldest place in the world. This was a freak snowstorm once in a 50-year or whatever. But there are far colder places in the world in which natural gas works reliably 24/7 at far, far worse weather. The problems for Texas, there may have been problems with the gas facilities that made them malfunction. But I think the obvious culprit, and of course the media doesn't like to do this and admit this because it's their darling. The obvious culprit is the fact that a lot of the energy capacity of Texas is reliant on solar and wind, and these just don't blow. These just don't work during the times when you need them the most. So when you have, after the snowstorm passes, there's very little wind. And the windmills freeze and stop working in the cold. And then, of course, during the solar storm, there's very little solar power. So then you can't have that. So the fact that these two energy sources are a growing percentage of the Texas grid means that in cases of extreme demand, while they are not able to provide enough energy, you can end up with failures that impact the gas turbines. You know, maybe there was something wrong with gas turbines, but gas turbines can be made to work for something like this. But alternatives or renewables cannot be made to work. There's no way that you can turn on the sun in the middle of a snowstorm. You know, the implication of this, again, is in terms of renewables, ultimately the problem with these energy sources is that they're not high power on demand. It's a lot of power when you don't want it, and sometimes not a lot of power when you want it. And so the cost of managing that irritability of the grid is enormous. It's leading to massive increases in the cost of electricity in places like Britain and Germany and California. Is to draw analogy with Bitcoin mining, a lot of people think these technologies will be useful for Bitcoin mining, but I think if your miner can't be up for 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, if you don't have that energy source reliably available, then your miner, your mining machine is likely, is depreciating, and you're likely not going to be competitive with people who are able to run their machines at 24/7. So I can't really see mining with these being possible because of the reliability problem. But I think perhaps mining could play a role in improving the reliability of fossil fuel by, you know, allowing places to build a little bit of excess capacity, which they usually use to mine Bitcoin. But then in case of an emergency, you can just switch off the Bitcoin miners and have the extra energy being given to the grid. Ultimately, the problem with renewables is that you need to have a hydrocarbon or nuclear or hydroelectric plant that is able to produce peak demand. If you don't have that, then you can't count on the others not being producing peak demand. So anyways, you need to build the fossil fuel plant that can handle peak demand. But if you're building that, adding solar and wind to it is just going to increase your costs and make your management of the power load more complicated than if you just have the plant itself. That's why none of these things work on the grid, except with government subsidies, except with massive amount of economic incentive, because the market cannot finance these things because it's economically suicidal to be doing that. So I don't see a big role for renewables in mining Bitcoin. And in fact, I think the optimistic thing here is that it's kind of the opposite, in that what Bitcoin is doing is that it's allowing any high power energy source to monetize and to be sold anywhere in the world, regardless of its location. So it's going to be a great subsidy for high power production all over the world. And, you know, in a time when governments are launching war on effective energy sources in order to subsidize these unreliable ones, Bitcoin is effectively flipping the script. It's launching war on government financing in order to subsidize high power energy sources. And on that positive note and cheerful note, I'm going to have to end. I'm going to have to leave for now. But you guys feel free to stick around and continue the discussion if you'd like. I'll watch the end of it some other time. Okay, Peter, I trust you to continue to with the moderation.
Okay, thanks. So.
All right. Cheers. Take care, guys.
Cheers, Steve. So just on that question, I've heard it suggested by various people that Bitcoin mining could be a way of evening out the unreliability of renewables. I think maybe Gail, who used to be in this group, had some kind of theory about that. And Safe clearly, just in his answer there, is saying that that doesn't seem particularly likely. And I'm inclined to agree with him, because the main cost with the Bitcoin mining comes from the capital equipment. And well, that's one of the main costs. And if you're not running that 24/7, you've just got a major disadvantage against all of the other miners. So I wanted to like ask if anyone else has a perspective on that. Anyone else heard that argument? And like, does anyone have a view on whether it could be something that would complement renewables?
Rather than renewables, I think that argument's better applied to currently inefficient or wasted fossil fuels. For example, the burn off in oil fields. We can now use that because that energy is there. It is reliable. It's just inconvenient for other uses. Now we don't have to throw it away. We can put it to good work. As yeah. opposed to taking up land and resource to build a solar panel field. Although, yeah. I suppose, on the extreme, there's an argument that now we can go out in the middle of nowhere with low-value land and put it to work with solar panels, but you're still battling the unreliability. I think that argument's better applied. Let them develop the argument, and then we'll apply it to inefficient fossil fuels.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, that's always seemed like the strongest use case, the burn-off from oil fields, because that is already a huge amount of energy that's kind of just being wasted. I think it's the methane burn-off, isn't it, where you're burning methane that's coming from oil fields, which would be quite a potent greenhouse gas. And you're turning it into CO2, basically, and so reducing the greenhouse effect from it. But yeah, you still with that would still have the problem of not being able to. Well, actually, I suppose it is more reliable, isn't it? That methane burnt runoff from oil fields. Oh, so you could.
Not only is it reliable, a lot of that burn off, people assume that it's inefficient fossil fuel. It's not. It's, as a matter of fact, a lot of the burn off is the highest efficient fossil fuel. Right. I wish I had the company's name at hand. I don't. I apologize. But there is a company, Max Kaiser interviewed the head of the company the other day, as a matter of fact. And they are taking, basically, they back a truck up to a oil field with a shipping crate on it that's been converted into a Bitcoin mining device. It's pretty incredible. So it's already happening.
Interesting. Marquis, you got your hand up?
I think those of us that are against, I guess, slavery, whether it's globally or in the U.S., right? The best case would be to, let's keep burning those fossil fuels so that we don't enslave ourselves again. But that may be inappropriate. I don't know, but we'll see.
There's one thing I've been thinking about, guys. I interviewed Jeff Booth again last night, and just keep thinking about his book and how technology drives deflationary pressure on any good or services or products that it, you know, should ever exist. And then you look at fossil fuels, oil in particular. How is it we're pulling over 20 million barrels of the stuff a day out of just one country sometimes in the Middle East, but yet the prices of our fuel still keep steadily going up? And we know for a fact we've been doing this for decades. So we know the efficiency is there. We know the technology has driven productivity. We know, therefore, we know the supply and the demand. What we have in the middle is the oil cartel, the nations that form that oil cartel to keep prices propped up. And of course, then we have different regulations around the oil and gas industry. Some, I'm sure, are put in place for a good reason. Others probably are just completely overreaching, like many governments and policymakers like to do. And one example that I know for sure, refineries, it's extremely difficult to, it's called crack a barrel of oil into the different products across the spectrum of products that we need, from naphtha all the way down to like the crude at the very bottom. You know, it's a different form of fuel that, you know, we use to power our cars, that is to heat our homes, that is to fly a jet. That is a very complex thing to do, but they can set up the refineries to do all of that. But then, of course, you've got these lobbyists for corn and soy that are pushing all of, and we have mountains of this stuff, mountains of it. We know it's rotting somewhere because we see it all over the news, rotting piles of grains. So that's getting pushed into the fuel complex. And that makes it almost impossible for these refineries to work at their total optimum, complete total production, which would drive down prices. That is just the deflationary pressure that technology pushes on this industry, or should push on this industry. So therefore, we should all be swimming in the stuff, to use the analogy. We shouldn't be paying anywhere near what we're paying for this kind of energy. And if that were the case, then people would have the time and energy and incentive to clean that up. So if we were all to agree that there is too much toxic waste gases going into the air by virtue of pulling this stuff out of the ground, instead of keeping the refineries busy on trying to stick ahead of the game just to be profitable at the margin, well, if they were already profitable because they had just so much productivity and effective ways of getting, which we know exist, of getting the product to market, then they can iterate on other parts of their business and other parts of their business, making it cleaner, making it safer, making it more accessible to Bitcoin miners who want to come in and use and feed off of their already brilliant business model. I don't know. That one's just been sitting with me for a little while, and I'd be interested to hear anybody else's thoughts.
That's interesting, because a side hobby of mine is regenerative agriculture. And something I've noticed is that a lot of, not the local growers just trying to grow local food, which I don't have a problem with that, but I'm talking more of industrial agriculture. There's a large segment that are starting to cut way back on their fossil fuel inputs, which includes high levels of land tillage and also high levels of chemical inputs, which are derived from fossil fuels. And they're drastically reducing that and increasing labor, which seems counterintuitive. But what they're doing is using ruminant animals to actually use solar energy via grasses and other animal inputs. What I'm starting to realize is, even though that's counterintuitive, what you're really seeing is the fact that fiat currencies and being able to manipulate and try to overmanage or bureaucratically manage agriculture, it's not only that we have a negative view of the use of fossil fuels, we make sure we do it inefficiently. We use them for the wrong thing in a lot of cases. What I'm starting to realize is that results in kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. These people make an argument that they're causing, which makes it extremely hard to have a discussion with them. They're going to win that argument every time. It dovetails with what Chris just said. It's a similar phenomenon.
What do you reckon, Daniel?
Yeah, I agree. And it's a shame Saif has jumped off, because this is his big plan in Jordan, right? To repasteurize the deserted land over there, the desertification that's taken place with sheep primarily. That's what he wanted to do. So we'll have to you have to swing that question by him on the next seminar.
Yeah, I was disappointed when he dropped off to need more time.
So has anyone in the chat read Alex Epstein's book in a conversation?
No, but I'm going to now.
Yes, yeah, it's a very interesting book.
I've listened to him when Saif had him on here. So that was very, very eye-opening. And I just realized, well, this is what Bitcoin does, doesn't it? It shines a light on you, holds the mirror up to yourself. And I realized, oh my God, I'd fallen for a lot of greenwashing over the last 5 to 10 years in particular. And listening to that was very interesting. To help me come to that realization. Now I'm much more critical about the information that's coming our way when it's concerning the environmental impact of certain industries and certain businesses. And I always want to know what's the hidden narrative. Obviously, with Bitcoin mining, it's pretty clear that they just want to attack Bitcoin for the sake of attacking this new technology, which they don't understand, you know, that which we do not understand, we must destroy. That's pretty much what's going on with Bitcoin FUD. And it's going to be a couple of years before that, and a lot of hard work, okay, for it to turn around.
Yeah, he makes a really powerful case in general for the ways in which fossil fuels contribute to the outcomes that are generally thought to be positive for human life, such as, you know, life expectancy and you know, the development of agriculture in particular being so dependent on the use of fossil fuels like oil. He goes into detail on all of that and runs through the arguments in a really convincing way, and I really recommend checking out some of the debates he's done as well. It's quite an interesting story behind this guy, because he's a relatively young guy. Basically, he studied philosophy at university, and he found that focusing on the issue of energy was a way that he could apply his logical thinking to a really practical, important ethical issue. And he ended up with just like becoming an expert in energy, really focusing on this. And he challenged loads of really prominent, like some of the world's leading environmentalists, like Phil McKibben, who's like, we mentioned Paul Ehrlich before in the context of the Julian Simon wager in various Safer Dean episodes. And he's like quite close to Paul Ehrlich on, you know, they know each other. And he's also done a debate with Robert F. Kennedy. So he's gonna like put himself out there against people who are, I think he was in his 20s when he did these debates, but put himself out there against people who've been doing this for decades, who are like steeped in all of the fiat literature on the topic. And I mean, I'll let people decide for themselves, but I think he does a fantastic job of defending the pro-fossil
fossil fuel case in these debates. So yeah, I recommend to people, like, check out, just type in Alex Epstein to YouTube and check out a few of his debates. There's about three really good ones that he's done.
Is he a Bitcoiner as well? Has he been orange-pilled?
I think he's not a Bitcoiner yet, but I think he's sympathetic to it. So when he came on, I'm basing that off what he said when he came on Safe's podcast. He said that he didn't own any Bitcoin at that stage. I think he's particularly engaged with Bitcoiners. He seems to be very focused on energy from what I understand. But I think he's definitely a prime candidate for orange pilling. So maybe you can try getting him on your podcast, Dan, and do a follow-up conversation. Maybe that will help.
Yeah. Well, if one of his first touches was Safe, then, you know, they're pretty big boots to fill. I was going to say, yeah, I should tune in to more of his work, because I did find it completely fascinating. Did you come away after listening to that and reading that with the same realization that I had about being greenwashed?
I did. And I used to work in the sector, actually. I used to be a climate change officer for the British government in China. So I was steeped in all of the arguments for reducing CO2. And I think one of the things that Alex's work really, like, brought across was one of the key points he makes is that the environment is not this, like, lovely place that we just need to preserve and then everything will be fine. The natural environment around us is inherently hostile. If we didn't have fossil fuels, all of us would be dead within a matter of days. Like, in most parts of the world, particularly like Northern Europe and colder places around the world. So the environment itself, there's, you know, you can make an argument that we've sort of evolved to adapt to an environment, but over the span of human history, the temperature of the earth has changed quite a lot. And there's this kind of inherent assumption behind the climate change movement that what we have now is sort of the ideal temperature. And it's by no means obvious that that's the case. And especially when you factor in things like, you know, people often talk about feedback loops in terms of climate change and the way that if you increase emissions, then that will, you know, result in temperature rising even further because of effects like ocean acidification, ice caps melting, stuff like that. But there's also feedback loops that go in the other direction. So when you have more CO2 in the atmosphere, that causes global greening. So there are more plants that will grow as a result of higher CO2 concentration. And in the book, Alex shares some photographs of this, like what it looks like when you have a plant that's growing in like 200 parts per million CO2, 300, 400. 400 is roughly where we are at the moment. And it's just like the plants grow way, way quicker. It's just really noticeable, really obvious. And so if you're doing that on a global scale, then you're going to get much more greening. You're going to get much more plant life growing across the world. And of course, plant life extracts CO2 from the atmosphere. So there's this sort of, there's the question of, firstly, is the science right in terms of, you know, CO2 rises being a disaster? I'm less convinced of that, although I'm not firmly on one side of the fence or the other, to be on a personal level. But I think the key thing that Alex's work drove home to me was just the fact that we need to look about at the question of fossil fuels in terms of what our objectives are. And all the evidence, although there have been predictions about, you know, disaster, not just related to fossil fuels, but like, you know, Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, that was written in 1968. And that was saying that we're all going to die of starvation because we're going to run out of food. There have been scares about all kinds of environmental problems for as long as we've had, you know, the written word. And none of them have really manifested themselves in disaster. What's actually helped us to improve the quality of life has been economic development. And the use of energy has been absolutely crucial to that economic development. So to me, that's like the crux of the argument. I think Alex makes that really, in a really compelling way in the book and his lectures.
Yeah. I guess we needn't worry about environmental disaster anyway, because we're all going to die of COVID. So
true. That's the main point I didn't address. Yeah.